bank enshrouded them, as though God himself were giving cover, and the old ship chugged away from the shores of France at her top speed of 7 knots an hour. In a matter of moments, she was beyond the 3-mile zone and into the waters of no man's land. The first round had been won by the Mossad Aliyah Bet. A blue and white Jewish flag was struck to the mast, and the Carpathus changed her name to the Star of David. The boat bounced miserably. The lack of ventilation in the over-jammed holds turned everyone pale. Karen worked with the Palmach teams, feeding lemons and applying compresses to stave off a major epidemic of vomiting. When lemons failed, she went to work quickly with the mop. She found that the best way to keep things quiet was to sing and invent games and tell funny stories. She had the children under control, but by noon the heat worsened and the air grew more rancid, and soon the stench of sweat and vomit became unbearable in the semi-lit hold. Men stripped to shorts and women to their brassieres, and their bodies glistened with sweat. An outbreak of fainting began. Only the unconscious were taken up on deck. There was simply no room for the others. 3 doctors and 4 nurses, all refugees from La Ciotat, worked feverishly. "Get food into their stomachs," they ordered. Karen coaxed, coddled, and shoved food down the mouths of her children. By evening she was passing out sedatives and giving sponge baths. She washed them sparingly, for water was very scarce. At last the sun went down and a breath of air swept into the hold. Karen had worked herself into exhaustion, and her mind was too hazy to permit her to think sharply. She fell into only a half sleep with an instinctive reflex that brought her awake the second one of her children cried. She listened to every creak of the old ship as it labored for Palestine. Toward morning she dozed off completely into a thick, dream-riddled sleep filled with annoying confusion. A sudden roar brought her awake with a start. She looked up the ladder and it was daylight. Karen pushed her way up. Everyone was pointing to the sky where a huge 4-engined bomber hovered over them.
"British Lancaster bomber!"
"Everyone return to your places and be calm," the loudspeaker boomed. Karen rushed back to the hold where the children were frightened and crying. She began singing at the top of her voice, urging the children to follow. "Onward, onward to Palestine, in happiness we throng. Onward, onward to Palestine, come join our happy song."
"Everyone keep calm," the loudspeaker said. "There is no danger."
By noontime, a British cruiser, HMS Defiance, appeared on the horizon and bore down on the Star of David, blinker lights flashing. A sleek little destroyer, HMS Blakely, joined the Defiance. The 2 warships hovered about the old tramp as she chugged along.
"We have picked up our royal escort," Bill Fry said over the loudspeaker.
By the rules of the game, the contest was over. Mossad Aliyah Bet had gotten another ship out of Europe and onto the high seas. The British had sighted the vessel and were following it. The instant the Star of David entered the 3-mile limit off Palestine, she would be boarded by a British landing party and towed off to Haifa. On the deck of the Star of David, the refugees hooted at the warships and cursed Bevan. A large sign went up which read, "Hitler murdered us and the British won't let us live." The Defiance and the Blakely paid no attention and did not, as hoped, miraculously disappear. Once her children were calmed, Karen had more to think about. Many of them were becoming quite sick from the lack of air. She went topside and inched her way through the tangle of arms, legs, and knapsacks up to the captain's bridge. In the wheel room, Bill Fry was sipping coffee and looking down at the solid pack of humanity on deck. The Palmach head was arguing with him.
"Jesus Christ," Bill growled. "One thing we get from Jews is conversation. Orders aren't made to be discussed, they are made to be obeyed. How in the hell are you guys going to win anything if you've got to talk everything over? Now I'm the captain here."
Bill's outburst hardly fazed the Palmach chief, who finished his argument and walked off. Bill sat mumbling under his breath. He lit a cigar butt and then saw Karen standing rather meekly in the doorway.
"Hi, sweetheart,"
he said, smiling.
"Coffee?"
"I'd love some."
"You look bad."
"I can't get too much sleep with the children."
"Yeah? How are you getting along with them kids?"
"That's what I came to talk to you about. Some of them are getting quite sick, and we have several pregnant women in the hold."
"I know, I know."
"I think we should have a turn on deck."
He pointed down to the solid cluster of bodies.
"Where?"
"You just find a few hundred volunteers to exchange places."
"Aw, look now, honey. I hate to turn you down, but I've got a lot on my mind. It just ain't that easy. We can't start moving people around on this, can?"
Karen's face retained a soft sweetness, and her voice showed no anger.
"I am going back down there, and I'm taking my children on deck," she said.
She turned her back and started for the door.
"Come back here! How did a sweet-looking kid like you get so ornery?"
Bill scratched his jaw.
"All right, all right. We'll get them brats of yours topside. Jesus Christ, all I get is arguments, arguments, arguments."
That night, Karen led her children to a place on the fantail of the ship. In the cool and wonderful air, they fell into a deep and peaceful sleep. The next day, the sea was smooth as glass. Dawn brought more British patrol planes, and the now familiar escort, the Defiance and Blakely, were still there. A tremor of excitement ran through the ship as Bill announced that they were less than 24 hours from Eretz Yisrael, land of Israel. The mounting tension brought on a strange quiet that lasted far into the day. Toward evening, the Blakely moved very close to the Star of David. A booming British voice cut over the water from the Blakely's loudspeaker.
"Immigrant ship, this is Captain Cunningham of the Blakely here. I want to speak to your captain."
"Hello, Blakely,"
Bill Fry's voice growled back.
"What's on your mind?"
"We would like to send an emissary aboard to speak to you."
"You can speak now. We're all Mishpoka here, and we got no secrets."
"Very well. Sometime after midnight, you will enter the territorial waters of Palestine. At that time, we intend to board you and tow you to Haifa. We want to know if you are going to accept this without resistance."
"Hello, Cunningham. Here's the picture. We've got some pregnant women and sick people aboard here, and we would like you to accept them."
"We have no instructions. Will you accept our tow or not?"
"Where did you say?"
"Haifa."
"Well, I'll be damned. We must be off course. This is a Great Lakes pleasure boat."
"We will be compelled to board you forcibly."
"Cunningham!"
"Yes?"
"Inform your officers and men. You can all go to hell."
Night came. No one slept. Everyone strained through the darkness for some sight of shore. The first look at Eretz Yisrael. Nothing could be seen. The night was misty, and there were no stars or moon, and the Star of David danced on brisk waves. Around midnight, a Palmach section head tapped Karen on the shoulder.
"Karen," he said, "come up to the wheelhouse with me."
They threaded their way over the prone bodies to the wheelhouse, which was also packed with 20 of the crew and Palmach section heads. It was pitch black inside, except for a bluish light from the compass. Near the wheel, she could make out the husky outline of Bill Fry.
"Everyone here?"
"All accounted for."
"All right. Pay attention."
Bill's voice sounded in the darkness.
"I've talked it over with the Palmach heads and my crew, and we've reached a decision. The weather off Palestine is socking in solid, fog all over the coast. We are carrying an auxiliary motor aboard capable of boosting our speed to 15 knots. In 2 hours, we will be inside territorial waters. If this weather stays bad, we've decided to make a run for it and beach ourselves south of Caesarea."
An excited murmur raced around the room.
"Can we get away from those warships?"
"They'll think this tub's the Thunderbird before I'm finished,"
Fry snapped back.
"How about radar? Won't they keep us on their screens?"
"Yeah, but they ain't gonna follow us too close to shore. They're not going to risk beaching a cruiser.
How about the British garrison in Palestine?
We have established contact with the Palmach ashore. They are expecting us. I'm sure they'll give the British an interesting evening. Now, all of you section leaders have had special instructions at La Ciota in beaching operations. You know what to expect and what to do. Karen, and you other two chiefs with children, better wait here for special orders. Any questions?
There were none.
Any arguments?
There were none.
I'll be damned. Good luck, and God bless all of you.
Chapter 17. A wind-driven mist whistled around the ancient and abandoned port of Caesarea, Palestine, and its heaps of rubble, broken walls, and moss-covered harbor, which was in use 400 years before the Christian era. For 5 long centuries, Caesarea, built by Herod in honor of Caesar, had been the capital of Roman Palestine. All that was left was ruin. The wind howled and churned up the water into a swirling foam which dashed against rocks jutting far into the sea. Here the revolution against Roman tyranny ended with the slaughter of 20,000 Hebrews, and their great sage, Rabbi Akiva, who had called his people to fight for freedom with Bar Kokhba, met his martyrdom. The Crocodile River still flowed to the sea where Akiva was skinned alive. A few yards south of the ruins were the first buildings of a collective Jewish fishing village named Sdot Yam, Fields of the Sea. This night, no fisherman or his wife slept. They were all crouched throughout the ruins, and they silently, breathlessly strained their eyes to the sea. They numbered 200, and were joined by 200 more Palmach soldiers. A flashlight signal blinked out from the ancient tower of Drusus, which jutted into the surf, and everyone tensed. Aboard the Star of David, Bill Fry's teeth tightened on a cigar stub, and his hands tightened on the wheel of the old ship. He zigzagged her in slowly, inching past treacherous reefs and shoals. On deck, the refugees pressed toward the rail and steeled themselves. The Star of David shuddered and creaked as her timbers slashed into a craggy boulder. A single flare spiraled into the air. The melee was on. Everyone scrambled over the sides, diving into shoulder-high water, and began fighting foot by foot through the surf toward the shoreline several hundred yards away. As the flare burst, the fishermen and Palmachniks scrambled from their cover and waded out to meet the refugees. Many slipped and fell into potholes or were overturned by a sudden wave and went down on slimy rocks, but nothing could stop them. The two forces met. The strong hands from the shore grabbed the refugees and began dragging them in. "Quick, quick," they were ordered. "Take off your clothing and change into these at once. Throw away any identification papers. Those dressed, follow us. Move, move, move. Quiet. No noise. No lights." The refugees tore the drenched clothing from their bodies and put on the blue uniforms of the fishermen. "Mingle. Everyone mingle." On deck of the Star of David, Karen handed children down to the Palmachniks, one by one, as fast as they could make a trip in and come back out. Strong, sure-footed men were needed to hold the children in the surf.
"Faster! Faster!"
There were uninhibited cries of emotion from some who fell on the holy soil to kiss it.
"You will have plenty of time to kiss the ground later, but not now. Move on!"
Bill Fry stood on his bridge barking orders through a megaphone. Within an hour, nearly everyone had abandoned the Star of David, except for a few dozen children and the section chiefs. 30 kilometers to the north, a Palmach unit staged a devastating assault on some British warehouses south of Haifa in an effort to divert the British troops in that area away from the beaching operation at Caesarea. On the beach, the fishermen and Palmachniks worked rapidly. Some of the refugees were taken into the village and others to trucks which sped them inland. As the last of the children was handed over the rail of the Star of David, Bill Fry tore down the ladder to the deck and ordered the section heads over the side. Karen felt the icy water close over her head. She balanced on her toes, treaded water for a moment, and found her direction. She swam in close enough to find footing. Ahead of her, on the beach, She could hear confused shouts in Hebrew and German. She came to a huge rock and crawled over it on all fours. A wave washed her back into the sea. Now she worked to solid ground and pushed in foot by foot against a driving undertow. Downed again on all fours, she crawled closer to the shore. A piercing sound of sirens, an ear-splitting crackle of rifle fire. On the beach, everyone was dispersing. Karen gasped for breath as she emerged into knee-high water, holding her side. Directly before her stood a half-dozen khaki-clad British soldiers with truncheons in their hands.
"No!" she shrieked. "No, no, no!"
She hurled herself into the cordon, screaming, clawing, and kicking with fury. A strong arm seized her from behind, and she was wrestled into the surf. Her teeth sank into the soldier's hand. He yelled in pain and released her. She flung herself forward again, fighting like a savage. A second soldier held his truncheon high and brought it down, and it thudded against her head. Karen moaned, went limp, and rolled unconscious into the water. She opened her eyes. Her head throbbed horribly. But she smiled as she looked up into the face of stubble-jawed, bleary-eyed Bill Fry.
"The children!"
she screamed and spun off the cot. Bill's hands grabbed her.
"Take it easy. Most of the kids got away. Some of them are here."
Karen closed her eyes and sighed and lay back on the cot again.
"Where are we?"
"British detention camp, Atlit. It was a wonderful show. More than half the people got away. The British are so damned mad, they rounded everybody up and herded us off here. We got crew, fishermen, refugees, everybody mixed up in this mess. How do you feel?"
"I feel horrible. What happened?"
"You tried to whip the British army single-handed."
She pushed the blanket off and sat up again and felt the lump on the side of her head. Her dress was still damp. She stood and walked, a bit wobbly, to the tent opening. There were several hundred more tents and a wall of barbed wire. Beyond the barbed wire were British sentries.
"I don't know what came over me," Karen said. "I've never struck anyone in my life. I saw those soldiers standing there, trying to stop me. Somehow the most important thing that ever happened, happened that moment. I had to put my foot on Palestine. I had to, or I'd die. I don't know what came over me."
She sat down beside him.
"Want something to eat, kid?"
"I'm not hungry. What are they going to do with us?"
Bill shrugged.
"It will be light in a few hours. They'll start processing us and asking a lot of damned fool questions. You know the answers."
"Yes. I keep repeating that this is my country to whatever they ask."
"Yeah. Anyhow, they'll keep you here a couple of 3 months, and then they'll turn you loose. At least you're in Palestine."
"What about you?"
"Me? Hell, they'll throw me out of Palestine same as they did the last time. I'll get another Mossad ship, try another run on the blockade."
Her head began to throb, and she lay back, but she could not close her eyes. She studied Bill's grizzled face for many moments.
"Bill, why are you here?"
"What do you mean?"
"You're an American. It's different with Jews in America."
"Everybody is trying to make something noble out of me."
He patted his pockets and pulled out some cigars. They were ruined by the water.
"The Aliyah Bet came around and saw me. They said they needed sailors. I'm a sailor, been one all my life. Worked my way up from cabin boy to first mate. That's all there is to it. I get paid for this."
"Bill?"
"Yeah?"
"I don't believe you."
Bill Fry didn't seem to be convincing himself either. He stood up.
"It's hard to explain, Karen. I love America. I wouldn't trade what I've got over there for 50 Palestines."
Karen propped up on an elbow. Bill began pacing the tent and groping to connect his thoughts.
"We're Americans, but we're a different kind of Americans. Maybe we make ourselves different. Maybe other people make me different. I'm not smart enough to figure those things out. All my life, I've heard I'm supposed to be a coward because I'm a Jew. Let me tell you, kid, Every time the Palmach blows up a British depot or knocks the hell out of some Arabs, he's winning respect for me. He's making a liar out of everyone who tells me Jews are yellow. These guys over here are fighting my battle for respect. Understand that?
I think so.
Well, damned if I understand it.
He sat beside Karen and examined the lump on her head.
That don't look too bad. I told those limey bastards to take you to a hospital.
I'll be all right, she said.
Later that night, the Palmach staged a raid on the Atlit camp, and another 200 of the refugees escaped through a gaping hole blown in the barbed wire. Karen and Bill Fry were not among the escapees. When the full report of the Star of David episode reached Whitehall, the British realized they had to change their immigration policy. To date, the illegal runners had brought in loads of a few hundred. This ship had carried nearly 2,000, and the greater part of them had escaped in the beaching at Caesarea and the subsequent raid on Atlit. The British were faced with the fact that the French government openly supported the Jews and that one out of every six Jews in Palestine had entered illegally. And so the British were caught in a tangle. They were as far away from a final answer on the Palestine problem as they had ever been, and so it was decided that the Jews must be turned away from Palestine and not kept at Atlit. The camps on Cyprus were established as a direct result of the pressure of illegal immigration and specifically of the success of the Star of David expedition. Karen Hansen Clement was sent to the island of Cyprus on a British prison ship and interned in the Carolus camp. But even as the Carpathus, Star of David, lay wedged in the rocks off the shore of Caesarea and the surf pounded her to bits, the Mossad Aliyah Bet speeded up their operations, planning for more ships and larger numbers of refugees to follow in the wake. For six more months, the young girl stayed in the swirling dust of Carolus and worked among her children. Her time in the succession of DP and internment camps had done nothing to harden or embitter her. She lived only for the moment when she could once again see Palestine. Eretz Yisrael. The magic words became an obsession for her, too. Many hours had passed when Karen finished telling her story to Kitty Fremont. During the telling, a rapport had been established between them. Each detected the loneliness and the need for companionship of the other.
"Have you heard anything further about your father?"
Kitty asked.
"No, not since La Ciota, and that was very long ago."
Kitty looked at her watch.
"Goodness, it's past midnight." "I didn't notice the time," Karen said. "Neither did I. Good night, child. Good night, Kitty. Will I see you again?" "Perhaps. I don't know."
Kitty stepped outside and walked away from the building. The thousands of tents were still now. A searchlight from the watchtower swept over the waves of canvas. Dust kicked up and blew around her feet, and she tightened her coat. The tall figure of Ari Ben Canaan walked toward her and stopped. He handed her a cigarette, and they walked silently over the bridge out of the children's compound. Kitty stopped a moment and looked back, then continued on through the old people's area to the main gate.
"I will work for you on one condition," Kitty said. That girl does not go on the escape. She stays in this camp with me."
"Agreed." Kitty turned and walked toward the sentry house quickly. Chapter 18. The plan which David had romantically called Operation Gideon moved into action. At Carolus, a large batch of bills of lading and British Army identification cards were forged by Dove Landau and given to Kitty Fremont. She carried them from the camp and turned them over to Ari Ben Canaan. The delivery of the bills of lading enabled Ben Canaan to complete the first phase of his scheme. During his survey of Cyprus, he had become familiar with a large British supply depot on the Famagusta Road near Carolus. It was a fenced-in area containing several acres of trucks and other rolling stock and a dozen enormous warehouses. During the war, the depot had been a major supply base for the Allies in the Middle East. Now some of the stock was still being shipped to British forces in that part of the world. Other stock had been declared surplus and had been bought up by private consignees. There was always some measure of movement from the depot to the Famagusta harbor. Mandria's Cyprus Mediterranean Shipping Company was the agent for the British Army on Cyprus. In that capacity, Mandria had a stock list and numbers of all the materials stored at the depot. He also had a very adequate supply of bills of lading. On Thursday, at 8 a.m., Ari Ben Canaan and 13 Palmachniks, all dressed in British uniforms and carrying British papers, pulled to a halt before the main gate of the depot in a British truck. Zev Gilboa, Yoav Yarkoni, and David Ben-Ami were in the working party. Ari, who was carrying papers as Captain Caleb Moore, presented a list of requisitions to the depot commander. Ari's working party had been detailed to gather the listed material and take it to the Famagusta docks for shipment aboard the SS Aiken. The forgeries were so perfect that the depot commander did not for a moment remember that Caleb was a spy from Moses in the Bible, and that the Aiken, a non-existent ship, carried the same name as the man who stole the treasury at Jericho. The first item the bills of lading called for was 12 trucks and 2 jeeps. They were rolled out of their parking area and checked out to Captain Caleb Moore. The working party then moved from warehouse to warehouse, loading their 12 new trucks with everything that would be needed for the Aphrodite Exodus to make her trip to Palestine with 300 escapee children. Yoav Yarkoni, who was in charge of fitting the ship, had drawn up a list of things which included a late-model radio receiver and transmitter, canned foods, medical supplies, flashlights, small arms, water cans, blankets, air conditioning units, a loudspeaker system, and 100 other items. Yoav was very sad because Ari had insisted he shave off his big black mustache. Zev's mustache met the same fate, for Ari feared this would identify them as Palestinians. In addition to supplies for the Exodus, David took a few tons of the things most urgently needed in Carolus. Zev Gilboa nearly went to pieces when he saw the British arsenal. In all his years in the Palmach, they had always needed arms, and the sight of so many lovely machine guns and mortars and carbines was almost more than he could stand. The working party moved with clock-like precision. Ari knew from Mandria's lists where everything was located. Yoav Yarkoni rounded out the afternoon's work by taking a few cases of scotch and a few of brandy and a few of gin and a few of wine for medicinal purposes. 12 brand new trucks, crammed with supplies, supposedly headed for the Famagusta harbor, where both supplies and trucks would be put aboard the SS Aiken. Ari thanked the British commander for his excellent cooperation, and the working party left 6 hours after it had entered. The Palmachniks were flushed with the ease of their initial victory, but Ari did not give them time to rest or be too proud of themselves. This was but a beginning. The next stop of Operation Gideon was to find a base for the trucks and material they had stolen. Ari had the answer. He had located an abandoned British camp on the outskirts of Famagusta. It had apparently been used once by a small service unit. The fence was still up. 2 wooden office shacks and the outhouses remained. Electric wiring from the main line was still in. During the night and for the next 2 nights, all the Palmachniks from Carlos came to this camp and labored feverishly, pitching tents, cleaning the area, and generally making it appear to be once again in service. The 12 trucks and 2 jeeps were painted the khaki color of the British Army. On the doors of each vehicle, Yoav Yarkoni drew an insignia which could be mistaken for any one of 1,000 Army insignias, and the lettering 23rd Transportation Company, HMJFC. The company office had enough actual and forged British papers and orders strewn about to give it an authentic look. In 4 days, the little camp with the 12 trucks looked quite natural and unimposing. They had taken enough British uniforms from the depot to dress the Palmachniks adequately as soldiers, and enough of everything else to stock the camp completely. As a finishing touch, Yorvar Kony put a sign over the entrance gate which read, 23rd Transportation Company, HMJFC. Everyone sighed with relief as the sign-raising officially dedicated the encampment. Zev looked at the sign and scratched his head.
What does HMJFC stand for?
His Majesty's Jewish Forces on Cyprus. What else?
Yoav answered. The pattern of Operation Gideon was set. Ari Ben Kanan had had the utter audacity to form a fake unit of the British Army. Wearing a British uniform, he had established Mossad Aliyah Bet headquarters in broad daylight on the Famagusta Road, and he was going to execute the final phases of his plan using British equipment. It was a dangerous game. Yet he held to the simple theory that acting in a natural manner was the best cover an underground agent had. The next phase of Operation Gideon became fact when three Americans from a merchant freighter landed in Famagusta and jumped ship. They were Mossad Aliyah Bet men who had received training during the war in the United States Navy. From another ship came two exiles of Franco Spain. Often former Spanish loyalists worked Aliyah Bet ships. Now the Exodus had a crew, the balance of which would be filled out by Ari, David, Yoav, and Zev. Hank Schlossberg, the American skipper, and Yoav set to the task of refitting the Exodus into an immigrant runner. Larnaca was a small port, and Mandria certainly knew the right way to produce silence over any unusual activity around the Aphrodite at the end of the pier. First, the cabins, holds, and deck were stripped clean of cabinets, bins, shelves, furnishings, and trimmings. The ship was turned into a shell from stem to stern. Two wooden shacks were constructed on deck to serve as toilets, one for the boys and one for the girls. The crew's mess hall was converted into a hospital room. There would be no formal mess hall or galley. All food would be eaten from cans. The galley was converted into an arsenal and storeroom. Crew's quarters were taken out. The crew would sleep on the small bridge. The loudspeaker system was hooked up. The ancient engine was overhauled thoroughly. An emergency mast and sail were constructed in case of engine failure. There were Orthodox children among the 300, and this posed a particular problem. Yarkoni had to seek out the head of the Jewish community on Cyprus and have kosher food especially processed and canned for them according to dietary law. Next, an exact cubic measurement of the hold was taken, as well as a surface measurement of deck space. Shelves, 17 inches apart, were built in the hold. These would serve as bunks and allow each child room to sleep on his stomach or back, but not the luxury of rolling over. They computed an average height for the children and allotted 4 feet 11 inches per child and marked it off down the shelves. The balance of the deck space in the hold and topside was also marked off, allowing a child just enough room to move an inch or two in each direction while asleep. The lifeboats were repaired. Large holes were cut into the sides of the ship and windpipes constructed so that air would be driven into the hold by electric fans. The air conditioning units taken from the British depot were also fitted in. Air had to be circulated at all times in the packed quarters to prevent mass vomiting. The work moved along smoothly. The sight of a half-dozen men working on the old salvage tub appeared quite natural in the Larnaca harbor. Loading supplies would pose another problem. Ari did not want to risk sending the khaki-colored trucks onto the dock, as he felt they were certain to attract attention. When the majority of the refitting had been completed, the Exodus stole out of Larnaca each night to a rendezvous cove a few miles away in the southern bay. Here, trucks from the 23rd Transportation Company, HMJFC, would come filled with supplies taken from the British depot. A constant stream of rubber boats moved from shore to ship all night until the Exodus was filled, inch by inch. At the children's compound at Carolos, Zev Gilboa carried out his part of Operation Gideon. He carefully screened 300 of the strongest boys and girls and took them in shifts to the playground, where they were toughened up by exercises and taught how to fight with knives and sticks, how to use small arms, and to throw grenades. Lookouts were posted all over the playground, and at sight of a British sentry, a signal would change the games of war into games of peace. In 3 seconds, the children could stop practicing gang fighting and start singing school songs. Groups not working out on the playground would be in the classroom learning Palestinian landmarks and the answers to mock questionings of British intelligence. At night, Zev would take them all to the playground and build a bonfire, and he and some of the Palmachniks would spin stories and tell the children how wonderful it would be for them in Palestine and how they would never live behind barbed wire again. There was a hitch in Operation Gideon, but it developed among Ari's closest lieutenants, David, Zev, and Yoav. Although David was a sensitive boy and a scholar, he feared no man when aroused. He was aroused now. The first expedition into the British depot had gone so well that he, Zev, and Yoav felt it was sacrilegious to leave as much as a shoestring in it. He wanted to run 23rd Transportation Company trucks into the depot around the clock and take anything not nailed down. Zev envisioned even taking cannons. They had gone so long on so little that this windfall was too great a temptation. Ari argued that greed could ruin the whole plan. The British were sleeping, but not dead. 23rd Transportation Company trucks should appear from time to time for the sake of naturalness, but to attempt to drain the depot would be to hang them all. Nonetheless, he could not hold them down. Their schemes began to sound wilder and wilder. Yoav had got so cocky that he even went so far as to invite some British officers to the 23rd Transportation Company for lunch. Ari's patience ran out, and he had to threaten to send them all back to Palestine in order to get them into line. In a little over 2 weeks after the beginning of Operation Gideon, everything was ready to go. The final phases of the plan, Mark Parker's story plus getting the 300 children to Kyrenia, awaited word from the British themselves. The final move would be made when the British opened the new refugee camps on the Larnaca Road and began transferring inmates from Carolus. Chapter 19. Caldwell, Sutherland's aide, went into the office of Major Alan Alastair, who was the intelligence chief on Cyprus. Alastair, a soft-spoken and shy-appearing man in his 40s, gathered a batch of papers from his desk and followed Caldwell down the hall to Sutherland's office. The brigadier asked Caldwell and Alastair to be seated and nodded to the intelligence man to begin. Alastair scratched the end of his nose and looked over his papers.
There has been a tremendous step-up of Jewish activity at Carolus in the children's compound, he said in a half-whisper. We analyze it as a possible riot or breakout.
Sutherland drummed his fingers on the desktop impatiently. Alastair always made him nervous with his quiet, hush-hush ways, and now he droned on through several more pages of information.
Dear Major Alastair, Sutherland said when he had finished, you have been reading to me for 15 minutes, and the theme of your story is that you suspect that some dire plot is being hatched by the Jews. During the past 2 weeks, you have attempted to plant 3 men inside the children's compound and 5 men elsewhere inside Carolus. Each one of your master spies has been detected within an hour and thrown out by the Jews. You have read to me 2 pages of messages which you have intercepted and which you cannot decode, and you allege they are being sent from a transmitter you cannot locate.
Alastair and Caldwell glanced at each other quickly as if to say, the old man is going to be difficult again.
Begging the brigadier's pardon, Alastair said, leaning forward, much of our information is always speculative. However, there has been concrete data handed down which has not been acted upon. We know positively that Carolus is riddled with Palestinian Palmach people who are giving military training on the playground. We also know positively that the Palestinians smuggle their people into Cyprus at a place near the ruins of Salamis. We have every reason to suspect that the Greek chap, Mandria, is working with them.
Blast it, I know all that, Sutherland said.
You men forget that the only thing that keeps those refugees from turning into a wild mob is the fact that these Palestinians are there. They run the schools, hospitals, kitchens, and everything else at that camp. Furthermore, they keep discipline and they prevent escapes by letting only certain people go in and out. Throw the Palestinians out and we would be begging for trouble.
Then hire some informers, sir, Caldwell said, and at least know what they are planning.
You can't buy a Jewish informer, Alastair said. They stick together like flies. Every time we think we have one, he sends us on a wild goose chase.
Then crack down on them, Caldwell snapped. Put the fear of God into them.
Freddy, 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 Sutherland said in dismay, lighting his pipe. There is nothing we can do to frighten those people. They are graduates of concentration camps. You remember Bergen-Belsen, Freddy? Do you think we can do anything worse to them?
Major Alastair was beginning to be sorry that he had asked Fred Caldwell to come in with him. He showed absolutely no latitude in his thinking.
Brigadier, Alastair said quickly, we are all soldiers here. Nonetheless, I'd be less than honest if I reported to you that everything was peaceful at Karaolos, and that I thought we'd be wise to continue to just sit and wait for trouble.
Sutherland rose, clasped his hands behind him, and began to pace the room thoughtfully. He puffed his pipe for several moments and tapped the stem against his teeth.
My mission here on Cyprus is to keep these camps quiet until our government decides what it intends to do with the Palestine Mandate. We are not to risk anything that could bring adverse propaganda.
Fred Caldwell was angry. He simply could not understand why Sutherland chose to sit and let the Jews drum up trouble. It was beyond him. Alan Alastair understood, but did not agree. He favored a quick counterblow to upset any Jewish plans in Karaolos. Nonetheless, all he could do was present the information. It was up to Brigadier Sutherland to act upon it. Sutherland, in his estimation, was being unreasonably soft.
"Is there anything else?" the brigadier asked.
"Yes, one more problem now, sir."
Alastair thumbed through his papers.
"I would like to know if the brigadier has studied the report on this American woman, Catherine Fremont, and the correspondent Mark Parker."
"What about them?"
"Well, sir, we are not certain if she is his mistress, but the fact that she has gone to work at Karaolos certainly coincides with his entry into Cyprus. From past experience, we know that Parker has anti-British leanings."
"Rubbish. He is an excellent reporter. He did a splendid job at the Nuremberg trials. We made a costly blunder once in Holland, and the man found it and reported it. That was his job."
"Are we correct in assuming, sir, that it is quite possible Mrs. Fremont's going to work in Karaolos may have something to do with helping Parker do an expose of the camp?"
"Major Alastair, I hope that if you are ever brought to trial for murder, the jury will not hang you on such evidence as you have just placed before me."
Little red patches dotted Alastair's cheeks.
"This Fremont woman happens to be one of the best pediatric nurses in the Middle East. She was cited by the Greek government for doing an outstanding job in an orphanage in Salonika. That is also in your report. She and Mark Parker have been friends since childhood. That is also in your report. It is also in your report that the Jewish welfare people sought her out.
Tell me, Major Alastair, you do read your reports, don't you?"
"But, sir, I haven't finished. Let us assume that the very worst of your suspicions are well-founded. Let us assume that Mrs. Fremont is gathering information for Mark Parker. Let us say that Mark Parker writes a series of articles about Karaolos. Gentlemen, this is the end of 1946. The war has been over for a year and a half. People are generally sick and tired of, and rather unimpressed with, refugee stories. What will impress people is our throwing an American nurse and newspaper man off Cyprus. Gentlemen,
The meeting is concluded. Alistair gathered his papers together quickly. Fred Caldwell had been sitting in cold and fuming anger. He sprang to his feet.
I say we kill a few of these sheenies and show them just who is running this show. Freddy!
Caldwell turned at the door.
If you are so anxious, I can arrange a transfer to Palestine. The Jews there are armed, and they are not behind barbed wire. They eat little men like you for breakfast.
Caldwell and Alistair walked briskly down the hall. Freddy grumbled angrily under his breath.
Come into my office, Alistair said.
Freddy flopped into a chair and threw up his hands. Alistair snatched a letter opener from his desk and slapped it in his open palm and paced the room.
Ask me, Caldwell said. They ought to give the old boy his knighthood and retire him.
Alistair returned to his desk and bit his lip hesitatingly.
Freddy, I've been thinking for several weeks. Sutherland has proven utterly impossible. I am going to write a personal letter to General Tevar Brown.
Caldwell raised his eyebrows.
That's a bit risky, old boy.
We must do something before this bloody island blows up on us. You are Sutherland's aide. If you back me up on this, I guarantee there will be no repercussions.
Caldwell had had his fill of Sutherland. Alistair was a relative of General Tevar Brown through marriage. He nodded.
And you might add a good word for me with Tevar Brown.
A knock on the door brought in a corporal with a new batch of papers. He gave them to Alistair and left the office. Alistair thumbed through the sheets and sighed.
As if I didn't have enough on my mind. There is a ring of organized thieves on the island. They are so damned clever we don't even know what they are stealing.
General Tevar Brown received Major Alistair's urgent and confidential report a few days later. His immediate reaction was to recall Alistair and Caldwell to London and to call them on the carpet for what amounted to mutiny. Then he realized that Alistair would not have risked sending such a letter unless he was truly alarmed. If Tevar Brown was to follow the advice of Alistair and make a quick raid on Karaolos to upset any plans the Jews might have, he had to move quickly, for although he didn't know it, Ari Ben Canaan had set the day, hour, and minute for taking the children out of Karaolos. The British announced that the new facilities near Larnaca were ready and a general evacuation of many of the overcrowded compounds at Karaolos would begin in a few days. The refugees would be moved by truck at the rate of 300 to 500 per day over a 10-day period. Ari chose the 6th day as the day. No tunnels, no crates, no garbage dumps. Ari was just going to drive up to Karaolos and take the children out in British trucks.
Chapter 20. Deliver in person to Kenneth Bradbury, Chief ANS, London Bureau. Dear Brad, this letter and enclosed report from Cyprus are being delivered to you by F.F. Whitman, a pilot with British Intercontinental Airways. D-Day on Operation Gideon is 5 days off. Cable me at once that you have received the report. I've used my own discretion on this thing. I feel that it can turn into something very big. On D-Day, I will send a cable to you. If my cable is signed Mark, that means that everything went off according to schedule, and it is okay to release the story. If it is signed Parker, then hold off, because that means something went wrong. I promised F.F. Whitman $500 for safe delivery of this to you. Pay the man, will you? Mark Parker. Mark Parker, Dome Hotel, Kyrenia, Cyprus. Aunt Dorothy arrived safely in London, and we were all happy to see her. Looking forward to hearing from you. Brad. Mark's story sat safely in the London ANS Bureau, to be released on signal. Kitty moved from the Dome Hotel to the King George in Famagusta when she went to work at Karaolos. Mark decided to stay put at the Dome in order to be on the spot in Kyrenia when the exodus came in. He had driven to Famagusta twice to see her. Both times she was out at the camp. Mandria confirmed what Mark suspected. The young refugee girl went to work as Kitty's aide. They were together all day long. Mark became worried. Kitty should have more sense than to try to bring her dead child to life through this girl. There seemed to him to be something unhealthy about it. In addition, there was the business of her carrying forged papers out of Carolos. There were only a few days left until Operation Gideon moved into the final phase. The tension harassed Mark, and Kitty's strange behavior harassed him even more. He made a date to meet her at the King George in Famagusta. As he drove to Famagusta, his nerves were on edge. It had all gone too easily. Ben Kanan and his gang of bandits had run circles around the British. The British were aware that something was happening, but they could not for the life of them seem to find the outside workers. Mark marveled at the finesse and skill of Ben Kanan and the courage of the Palmachniks. The outfitting of the Exodus, the training of the children had gone off perfectly. It would indeed be the biggest thing of his career. But because he was part of it all, he was very worried. He reached Famagusta and parked beside the King George Hotel, which was much like the dome in that it sat on a beach with terraces overlooking the water. He found Kitty at a table looking out at the sea.
"Hello, Mark,"
she said, and smiled and kissed him on the cheek as he sat beside her. He ordered drinks and lit a cigarette and one for Kitty. She was absolutely radiant. She seemed 10 years younger than she had that first day in Kyrenia.
"I must say you look the picture of happiness,"
she said in deference to his sour expression. The drinks arrived.
"Are you on pins and needles for the big moment?"
"Sure, why not?" he snapped. Their eyes met over the tops of their glasses. Kitty set hers down quickly.
"All right, Mr. Parker. You are all lit up like a road sign. You'd better start talking before you explode."
"What's the matter? You mad at me? You don't like me anymore?"
"For goodness sake, Mark. I didn't think you were so thin-skinned. I've been working very hard. Besides, we agreed it would be best not to see too much of each other during the last 2 weeks, didn't we?"
"My name is Mark Parker. We used to be friends. We used to talk things over."
"I don't know what you're driving at."
"Karen. Karen Clement Hansen, a little refugee girl from Denmark via Germany."
"I don't think there is anything to discuss."
"I think there is."
"She's just a lovely child I happen to like. She is my friend and I am her friend."
"You never could lie very well."
"I don't wish to talk about it."
"You're asking for trouble. The last time you ended up naked with a Marine in bed. This time I think you're going to have the strength to kill yourself." Her eyes dropped away from Mark's glare.
"Up to the past few weeks I've been so sane all my life," she said.
"Are you trying to make up for it all at once?" She put her hand on his.
"It has been like being born all over again. And it doesn't make sense. She is such a remarkable girl, Mark."
"What are you going to do when she goes on the Exodus? Are you going to follow her to Palestine?" Kitty squashed out her cigarette and drank her cocktail. Her eyes narrowed in an expression that Mark knew. "What have you done?" he demanded.
"She isn't going on the Exodus. That was my condition for going to work for Ari Ben Kanan."
"You damned fool. You damned fool, Kitty."
"Stop it," she said. "Stop making something indecent out of this. I've been lonely and hungry for the kind of affection this girl has to give, and I can give her the kind of understanding and companionship she needs."
"You don't want to be her companion. You want to be her mother."
"And what if I do? There's nothing wrong with that either."
"Look, let's stop yelling at each other. Let's calm down. I don't know what you have figured out, but her father is probably alive. If he isn't, she has a family in Denmark. Exhibition number 3. That kid is poisoned like they poison all of them. She wants Palestine." Kitty's face became drawn, and her eyes showed a return of sadness, and Mark was sorry.
"I was wrong not to let her go on the Exodus. I wanted to have her for a few months, to gain her complete confidence, to let her know how wonderful it would be to go to America. If I could be with her a few months, I'd be sure of myself.
Kitty, Kitty, Kitty. She isn't Sandra. You've been looking for Sandra from the moment the war ended. You were looking for her in Salonika, in that orphanage. Maybe that's why you had to take Ben Canaan's challenge, because there were children at Carolus, and you thought one of them might be Sandra.
Please, Mark, no more.
All right. What do you want me to do?
Find out if her father is alive. If he isn't, I want to adopt her and get her to the States.
I'll do what I can, he said. He spotted Ari Ben Canaan, dressed as Captain Caleb Moore, coming through to their terrace. Ari walked quickly to their table and sat down. The Palestinian was his usual cold, expressionless self. The instant Kitty saw him, her face lit up.
David just contacted me from Carolus. Something has come up that requires my immediate attention. I think, under the circumstances, that you had better come with me, he said to Kitty.
What is it? Both Mark and Kitty said together.
I don't know exactly. The Landau boy, the one who does our forgeries, he is now working on the transfer papers for getting the children out. He refuses to do any further work until he speaks to me.
What do you want me for? Kitty asked.
Your friend, the little Danish girl, Karen, is about the only person who can talk to him.
Kitty turned pale.
We must have those papers completed in the next 36 hours, Ari said. We may need you to talk to the boy through Karen.
Kitty stumbled from her chair and followed Ari blindly. Mark shook his head sadly, and his troubled glance remained on the empty doorway for many moments. Chapter 21 Karen stood in the classroom that was Palmach headquarters. She stared angrily at the boy with the soft face, blonde hair, and sweet appearance. He was a little small for 17 years, and the softness was deceptive. A pair of icy blue eyes radiated torment, confusion, and hatred. He stood by a small alcove which held the papers and instruments he used for his forgeries. Karen walked up to him and shook a finger under his nose.
Dove, what have you gone and done?
He curled his lip and grunted.
Stop growling at me like a dog, she demanded. I want to know what you have done.
He blinked his eyes nervously. No use arguing with Karen when she was angry.
I told them I wanted to talk with Ben Canaan. Why? See these papers? They are forgeries of British mimeographed forms. Ben Ami gave me a list of 300 kids here in our compound to be listed on these sheets for transfer to the new camp at Larnaca. They aren't going to the new camp. There's a Mossad ship out there someplace. It's going to Palestine. What about it? You know we don't question the Mossad or the Palmach. This time I do. Our name isn't listed. I'm not going to fix these papers unless they let us go too. You're not sure there is a ship? Even if there is, and we don't go, they have their reasons. Both of us have work to do right here in Carolus. I don't care whether they need me or not. They promised to get me to Palestine, and I'm going. Don't you think we owe these Palmach boys something for all they've done for us? Don't you have any loyalty at all? Done for us? Done for us? Don't you know yet why they're breaking their necks to smuggle Jews into Palestine? You really think they do it because they love us? They're doing it because they need people to fight the Arabs. And what about the Americans and all the others who aren't fighting Arabs? Why are they helping us? I'll tell you why. They're paying for their consciences. They feel guilty because they weren't put into gas chambers.
Karen clenched her fists and her teeth and closed her eyes to keep herself from losing her temper.
Dove, Dove, Dove. Don't you know anything but hate?
She started for the door. He rushed over and blocked her exit.
You're mad at me again, he said. Yes, I am. You're the only friend I've got, Karen. All you want to do is go to Palestine so you can join the terrorists and kill.
She walked back into the room and sat down at a desk and sighed. Before her on the blackboard was this sentence chalked in block letters. The Balfour Declaration of 1917 is the British promise of a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
I want to go to Palestine too, she whispered. I want to go so badly I could die. My father is waiting there for me. I know he is. Go back to your tent and wait for me, Dov said. Ben Canaan will be here soon.
Dov paced the room nervously for 10 minutes after Karen had gone, working himself up to greater and greater anger. The door opened. The large frame of Ari Ben Canaan passed through the doorway. David Ben-Ami and Kitty Fremont followed him. David closed the door and locked it. Dov's eyes narrowed with suspicion.
I don't want her in here, he said.
I do, Ari answered. Start talking.
Dov blinked his eyes and hesitated. He knew he couldn't budge Ben Canaan. He walked to the alcove and snatched up the mimeographed transfer sheets.
I think you have an Aliyah Bet ship coming into Cyprus, and these 300 kids are going on it.
That's a good theory. Go on, Ari said.
We made a deal, Ben Canaan. I'm not fixing these papers for you unless I add my name and the name of Karen Clement to this list. Any questions?
Ari glanced at Kitty out of the corner of his eyes.
Has it occurred to you, Dov, that no one can do your work and that we need you here?
David Ben-Ami said.
Has it occurred to you that both you and Karen have more value here than in Palestine? Has it occurred to you that I don't give a damn?
Dov answered. Ari lowered his eyes to hide a smile. Dov was tough and smart and played the game rough. The concentration camps bred a mean lot.